Has anything stayed in your fridge too long?
Oh, God, no. My fridge, nothing ever stays in my fridge too long. I keep recycling it. The problem is my husband will have a dinner, and he will take food from the dinner for his lunch the next day, and then he won't touch leftovers after that. So at holiday time, it becomes very tricky for me.
That's Dani Alexander. She produces KCUR's Up to Date, also heads up our social committee at the station, and that means she was in charge of last week's holiday potluck here at KCUR. People brought family favorites to share. I can tell you membership coordinator Kathleen Conahan-Gross knocked the kolaches out of the park, and IT guy Chris Pruitt's Japanese-style chicken curry was to die for, but I digress. On Friday, Dani was making good on her promise to throw out all the leftovers from the fridge before the weekend, and she was talking with one of our producers, Coy Duggar, about how she once unloaded Thanksgiving leftovers on her unsuspecting husband, who does not love sweet potatoes.
Probably the worst thing I ever did to him, I liked it, he ate it, but I didn't tell him it was all leftovers, was it was after a Thanksgiving dinner, so I had turkey leftover and stuffing and potatoes and gravy, which is all great ingredients for like a shepherd's pie. I don't think he was expecting the sweet potato to be in there. So I put that along the bottom rim, and then I put the mashed potatoes on top so he wouldn't see it, and then just baked it and presented it. And he was really gung-ho until he get into it, and then he got down to the, and he just kind of held it up on his fork with the, what the hell is this look?
Well, we are entering one of the great food-centric times of year for most people. You may see that look at your own holiday table. The holidays provide virtually limitless opportunities for food consumption, and with that abundance also comes leftovers and food waste, and for some, foodborne illness. So from the How to Ruin a Holiday files, I'm Brian Ellison in for Gina Kaufman today with a theme that we revisit from time to time here on KCUR Central Standard that we call, Are You Going to Eat That? Gina Roberts works with Novalize, a company that helps companies with food safety. She's joining us by Skype from Modesto, California. Hi, Gina.
Good morning, Brian. How are you doing?
I'm doing well, and welcome back to Central Standard. So let me ask you, you heard that story. Do you approve of Dani's shepherd's pie repurposing of potatoes and sweet potatoes and meat that she inflicted on her poor husband?
I do, absolutely. I think that's a very smart way to use leftovers.
All right. So affirmation for Dani's approach. What are your own plans for Thanksgiving, Gina?
Well, we certainly have a lot of family coming over on Wednesday or on Thursday, but the preparations really start on Tuesday or even on Wednesday. And then it'll just be a food fest the whole weekend, where I think the best meal is actually on Friday, the day after Thanksgiving, eating all those leftovers.
Why is that? Why is that better than the Thursday dinner?
You know, the Thursday dinner, I'm usually exhausted by the time I sit down to sure. eat because I've been cooking all day. And then the Friday dinner, all I have to do is heat it up safely, and then we're good to go.
Which is what we want to talk with you about today. We should add that Gina's here to help us with your questions, too, about what you can eat or what you should eat or what you must not eat, especially after that two-hour holiday dinner with all the stuff sitting out on the sideboard. So you can be thinking about your questions, too. Gina, let's start by talking turkey. I've been part of some families where the philosophy seems to be once you cook the turkey, it's fine. It's fine until you actually see things growing on it. Is that true?
No, I'm so sorry for you too, Brian,
to
be part of that family.
I appreciate that. I love my family. Don't get me wrong.
Yeah. When you you know, you've gone through a lot of effort to cook that turkey, to roast that turkey, and obviously your family, you are going to use a thermometer to check that the temperature reaches 165 while you're cooking it. You're going to pull it out and let it sit for probably about 20 minutes to let those juices settle. And then as you carve it and serve it, once you've taken it out of the oven, you've carved it, you're serving it, you can only leave it out for about 2 hours. Before you have to package it up and put it back in the refrigerator. And actually at that time, you're going to think, what can I eat in the next 4 days? And what, you know, might be too much for me to eat? If you've cooked a 20, 25 pound turkey and there's only four of you, you've got a lot of leftovers. So,
yeah. So that's 2 hours is not really that much time that the turkey should be sitting out. A lot of people, I think, at least leave it out till the sandwiches later in the evening.
You're right, it's not that much time, but you don't want to leave any of your food sitting out for more than 2 hours. That starts to become the danger zone where bacteria, bad bacteria that will make you sick, can start to grow. So that's why I enjoy the meal on Friday more than I enjoy the meal on Thursday, because the moment comes that you've made all this, you sit down and eat it, and then you've got to hop up and start putting things away in the refrigerator to keep it food safe.
Does anything depend on how well you took care of the bird before it was cooked? Does cooking reset the clock, kill all the bacteria and make everything safe kind of no matter what you did beforehand?
Not necessarily. So if you did leave that turkey out a little too long, or you left maybe the mashed potatoes out, 4 hours or even 5 hours, you can start to get some bacteria growing in there that produce toxins. And then those toxins are not killed upon heating or baking or reboiling or whatever you're doing to cook your product. So you really do want to mind that 2 hour rule for actually any dinner, any event that you have in your house.
Toxin is such a scary word.
It is. So there's some bacteria that produce chemicals, little toxins. Clostridium perfringens is one of them. And that affects you really quickly. So does Staph aureus. So it's a bacteria then that produces a toxin that will get you sick within 1 to probably 6 hours of eating that food product. So if you get sick right away after eating something, and it's not a fun sickness, then, it's because maybe somebody's left something out a little bit too long, somebody's handled a little bit too much, they weren't clean, they didn't wash their hands when they were making that food product.
And so how should you properly defrost the turkey to make sure that doesn't happen?
So you want to defrost your turkey in the refrigerator. You actually want to defrost any meat product in the refrigerator. You don't want to ever leave it on the counter to defrost it. And I know that that's a shortcut that some of us like to take, but you don't want to take that shortcut. The best way is really thawing that turkey in the refrigerator. You can also put it in a sink of cold water, and you can thaw your turkey that way, but I like to just keep it in the refrigerator, because then if I'm thawing my turkey in the sink, I worry about cross-contamination. I might get some turkey juice in my sink or on the counter, or I might get some splashback. So really, it's in the refrigerator, and you need to start thinking about that now. Today, your turkey probably better be in the refrigerator thawing.
Right. You can't wait till Thursday morning.
No.
So let me invite our listeners to ask their questions. What are your holiday food safety questions? Or maybe you have a leftovers triumph or a leftovers horror story you'd like to share. Give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet your questions. We're at KCURCST. Again, the number is 816-235-2888. Gina Roberts, a lot of fear and worry always seems centered on the stuffing, especially if you cook the stuffing in the bird. Should we be worried about that?
Well, I think you should be a little bit worried about it, but I stuff the turkey sometimes, maybe every other year I'll stuff it. And it's just as easy as taking the temperature, use a food thermometer, invest in a food thermometer, it's probably $5. And check the temperature of the stuffing and the turkey before you pull it out of the oven. The stuffing makes the turkey cook slower, so it'll take longer to cook. But boy, I love that stuffing coming out of a turkey.
And it's $165 for the stuffing as well?
It is. It absolutely is. And then I would say when you pull the turkey out of the oven, before you put that turkey back into your refrigerator, you're going to want to pull all the stuffing out of the turkey and put that into a separate container. So don't put the turkey back in the refrigerator stuffed.
All right. So store your stuffing separate from your turkey.
Yes.
All right. So certain things seem less risky to me. They're still part of the holiday, the corn, the green bean casserole. Are those things basically safe? Do you need to worry about how you take care of those?
Well, I think you need to worry about, any of the food products that you eat. The corn, there can be less risk to the corn than there can be certainly to the turkey, but you still want to put the corn back in the refrigerator within 2 hours after you've taken it off of the heat. You want to store it in containers with lids to prevent cross-contamination. So while your corn might be fine, you don't want to have it exposed to something else that might cross-contaminate it. And then if you have a lot of product, that green bean casserole, I would take the green bean casserole out of the original container, put it into another separate clean container with a lid. And the green bean casserole might be still pretty hot. Maybe you're really quick about getting it back in the refrigerator. So you might want to split it into two containers so that you don't have one large container that goes into the refrigerator hot.
And what's the problem with that?
it doesn't cool down quick enough then. And so then you've put your food into your refrigerator and you still are within that, you're not within the safety zone. So
it's
the safety
just like
zone
leaving
less...
it out then. Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like leaving it out.
Huh.
It doesn't cool down fast enough.
Okay. So we've been talking as though all the food comes out of the oven. It just sits there on the table. But what about something like hot plates or hot pots? Keeping something in the oven, if something stays warm, does that change the equation at all?
It does. So the clock starts ticking once you pull it out off the stove or out of the oven. So it could still be cooked, but then you've kept it in the oven at 140 degrees or higher just to stay warm, and that's fine. Sometimes okay. We will carve up the turkey, pass it on the table, and then we will go ahead and put it back in the oven to keep it warm. So then my 2-hour clock doesn't start ticking until I pull it out of the oven.
So here's another dispute that I think I've heard of in a lot of families, and this isn't just about holiday food, although maybe because there's so much food at the holiday, it seems relevant at that time. Once it's in the fridge, you've stored it properly, you've put it in there at the right time, just how long can it stay there exactly? What is the danger zone for how long a leftover can stay in the fridge?
Yeah, so the danger zone is 4 days. You have at the maximum 4 days to eat those leftovers, whether those are leftovers from Thanksgiving or leftovers from going out to dinner. It really is 4 days. If you think about it, there's been a lot of handling of the food, carving that turkey. You might have used your hands to put it on the plate. Some of the casserole dishes might get a little bit less handling by hands, but there's been a lot happening. And maybe they were right there at that 2-hour cusp before they got put in the refrigerator. So the safest is keeping leftovers in the refrigerators for 4 days.
You keep mentioning handling, and I think about the requirements in restaurants, for example, on how people have to handle food with gloves and hairnets and that sort of thing. That doesn't happen in many home kitchens. Are there things that people can do to handle food more safely?
Yeah, there is. We certainly don't wear gloves and hairnets in my house, even though I might be a little bit out there on food safety. But, you know, my girls, I have a 16-year-old and a 13-year-old. They help in the kitchen. They've got, you know, beautiful long hair. So I at least make them tie it back, because that's the last thing we want is some hair in our beautiful dinner.
Yes, for sure.
I have a 6-year-old also, and even he knows that before he can help mom in the kitchen or dad in the kitchen, he has to wash his hands first. So I think washing hands is probably the easiest thing that we can remember. You know, you want to wash your hands for 20 seconds in hot, soapy water. I have my kids just kind of sing happy birthday to themselves so that they don't shortcut washing their hands. You've also heard about using different cutting boards for different types of products. So we have a cutting board that we use only for meat and a cutting board that we use only for produce. And that's so that we make sure that we don't cross-contaminate between different types of food products, between our raw ingredients and our fresh ingredients. I think those are two really easy things to remember.
Even if you wash them in between the cutting boards, you just don't take the chance.
I don't take the chance. You certainly can wash them in between. And if I only had one cutting board and I had to do that, then I would do my fresh produce first and my raw meat second, if I could schedule it like that. And if I can't, then you want to make sure not only do you really clean it before you do your raw turkey and your produce, but I use a bleach water in my kitchen. So I would spray it with some bleach water. I would just take that extra step just to make sure that I'm not going to get any cross-contamination, because that's the last thing you want, is to have your friends or relatives or family sick from something you did in the kitchen.
You know, I think about some of the things we do around holidays, and I imagine they can't be terribly safe either. I'm thinking of appetizers, dips, where people are all dipping their chips into the same cheese sauce or a sour cream ranch dip or something. Are there steps that you recommend families take to just avoid risk that doesn't totally take all the fun out of the holiday?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, dips are my favorite, and I'm sure that people in my family double dip, even though we're not supposed to.
we've done an investigation. There has been some double dipping in your house, Gina.
Yeah,
I'm sorry.
I'll bet there has. So what I like to do is, with the dips in particular, those are you know, wonderful, delicious appetizers to have. But once we get ready to sit down for dinner, I might not have thrown those in the trash yet, but certainly after dinner, that's it. They go in the trash. I don't try to store them again. I don't try to keep them. The dips are not good leftovers because you've had so many hands and fingers and double dipping into that dip that that's it. It's just, it gets one shot.
So I do feel like I've been part of family dinners or larger gatherings with church dinners or something like that, that say, we have so many great leftovers here. Some of it's untouched. We should donate this somewhere. We should share this. Does that really work?
I think it does. As long as your food's safe. There was a study a couple years ago by the Harvard Food Law Policy Clinic that 40% of food produced in America goes to waste. So that's something that's really kind of near and dear to my heart too, is food waste. It's just being smart about food safety and handling your leftovers really smartly. And then if you have something that maybe it was a casserole or bread or a pie or desserts that weren't eaten during your potluck or your gathering, I think you get in touch with a local food center or food shelter and donate that. Absolutely. They have different rules and regulations that they have to follow. Some of them can accept your donation and some of them just aren't allowed to accept it.
Let's take a call. Sarah called us at 816-235-2888. Sarah from Kansas City, welcome to Central Standard.
Thank you very much for having me.
Thank you. What's your comment about food safety and the things you're hearing this morning?
Well, I'm glad you just brought it up. You just spoke about food waste, and that is a major concern for me. 4 days of really having to consume something that seems like a very short amount of time for me.
Sure. So what? Why is that of concern then? Are you suggesting that maybe we have too much food?
I do think that in this country that is a major concern. And just thinking that I have only 4 days to consume something before I throw it out just seems like a short amount of time.
Fair enough.
Do you feel like that might promote more food waste?
Well, it's a good question. Is food waste one of the negative consequences, Gina, of these recommendations you're making?
Not necessarily, because what I would say is when I'm ready to put my turkey back into the refrigerator, I take a look at it and I think, what can I eat in 4 days? And then what should I freeze? A lot of the things that you have for Thanksgiving dinner, you can freeze. We split our turkey and I put it into smaller, 1 pound, 2 pound bags. Some of it goes in the refrigerator and then some of it goes in the freezer. And that way I don't contribute less to the food waste that we do see in America. You know, same thing with the mashed potatoes. You can freeze some of those. The stuffing will freeze. In my house, the pies never make it past 4 days, so I don't have to worry about storage of those.
And how long does something keep in the freezer, Gina?
You know, in the freezer, you can say it's almost indefinite. What happens in the freezer is that there's no food safety issue of anything that you're putting in the freezer. It becomes a food quality issue. So you'll start to get freezer burn. So if you keep your turkey in the freezer too long, maybe you didn't package it up that well, and you go to pull it out 2 months later, it might not taste as delicious as it did on Thanksgiving Day. It's not a food safety issue at all. It's just a food quality issue. So there's some really good recommendations like on USDA's website on how long things can be in the freezer. And they can be there for quite a while.
All right. Is that satisfying, Sarah? Does that make you feel a little better about the food waste?
It does. Thank you very much.
Thank you. So if you had to give Gina one more tip to our listeners as they think about their holiday cooking and then what they're going to do with that food afterward, what would it be?
We haven't talked about this, but I would say clean out your refrigerator. So I did mine yesterday before I did my big Thanksgiving Day shopping, and I went through the refrigerator, and it doesn't really take that long. I wiped down the shelves with a little bit of white vinegar and water. To kind of disinfect. Again, I'm just kind of moving things around, wiping it down. I'm taking a look at what's been in my refrigerator. You know, if I don't know when it got put in there, then I'm throwing it away. I took a look at my condiments, my salad dressing, things that were from 2013. Even I had a salad dressing in there from 2013. I decided, nope, I'm going to throw that away. Probably not a food safety issue with salad dressing. It's just a food quality. I want my family to have some good fresh food.
Now you are provoking another family dispute about whether salad dressings ever really expire.
Yeah, most salad dressings, many, not all of them. A lot of salad dressings are very pH protects them from bacterial growth, so they're very acidic.
like, you know, lemon juice or vinegar is in there. So it prevents a lot of microorganisms from growing. But sometimes there's just the gross factor, too.
You're right.
You know,
which is powerful for me. Let's take one more call here from Janet in Kansas City North. Hi, Janet.
Hi there. Yeah. Well, I had a couple of things if we have time.
Just very quickly, if you would.
First of all, is vinegar also an all right thing to use rather than bleach water on your cutting board?
Okay, let's ask that one first. Gina, is it okay to use vinegar instead of bleach water?
Absolutely. That's a really good suggestion. Yep. Sometimes I do half water and half white wine vinegar to wash a cutting board.
Uh-huh.
Yep.
Okay, cool. And then also I wanted to pass along that I always, you know, when you're taking your turkey apart and everything and packaging it and all that stuff, I always make a broth out of the bones of the turkey. You can make some wonderful soup bases out of the bones of your chicken, turkey, whatever, that kind of thing. And then you can freeze that if you're not going to make a soup or a stew or something with that meat-based, you know. But you get some great broths, and you don't have to go out and buy them.
Good.
But you can freeze all that stuff. And I always put a date on anything that I stick in my plastic container in the freezer or the fridge or, you know, however. I always put the date on there to help remind myself, you know, with a Sharpie pen on the top of the plastic lid, and it washes off then when you wash your container, and that way I know the date on it.
Thanks, Janet, for those suggestions. Gina, good idea. Make the soup out of the turkey bones.
Excellent idea. Janet is my kind of woman. So again, let's try to reduce some of that food waste in America. And what we do in our family, again, because I'm just exhausted on Thanksgiving Day, is I do put the carcass in the refrigerator, a big old plastic bag in the refrigerator. And then the next day, my husband makes turkey soup. So we use everything safely.
Our callers are just going crazy now, Gina. The dam is open. So they have more questions they want to ask you. Let's take just one more call from Daisy in Kansas City, Kansas. Hi, Daisy.
Hi, Daisy. Hi. I love your show. I was calling because I used to work in a plastics facility, and we made bags. I want to let you know that there is truly a difference between freezer bags and non-freezer bags. There's actually a layer of nylon in there that is an oxygen scavenger. What happens in freezer burn is that oxygen forms ice crystals inside your bags, and you get freezer burn. But this also will show up in your food in the refrigerator. My food will last a lot longer by using freezer bags.
So freezer bags, especially for the freezer, rather than just other plastic bags. You concur, Gina?
I absolutely do. Actually, that's a good point, Daisy. I've done a lot of work in packaging, too, in kind of my past life. So I totally understand and agree with that.
Thanks, Daisy.
Thank you.
And thank you, Gina Roberts. She works with Novalize, a company that helps with food safety. She joined us by Skype from Modesto. Gina, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Happy Thanksgiving to everybody.
And to you. When we come back, one historic church in Kansas City has decided its name is sending the wrong message about who they are and what they believe, so they're changing it. We ask what's in a name and why it matters. After a short break, KCUR Central Standard will be right back. It's KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. It's not so unusual for a religious group to be named after the neighborhood where it exists, or something about where they are. So not too far from here, you can find Swope Parkway Church of Christ, or Central United Methodist, or Westport Presbyterian. It roots the congregation in the community. It helps people find them. But what happens when the name of the neighborhood, for some people, doesn't just send a message about where the church is? What if it's sending a more confusing message? Chase Peoples has been pastor for the last 5 years or so of, well, tell us the name of your church, Chase.
I'm the minister at Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ.
Now, that's a little bit of a mouthful in the first place, but the name comes from the Country Club neighborhood, which we'll hear more about here in a few minutes. When was this congregation founded?
Well, this church goes back to the beginning of what's called the Country Club District. In 1923, they began meeting in the Brookside Building, which is still there in the shops at Brookside. And they were able to get property where J.C. Nichols, big name in Kansas City history, had designed for a church to go in the neighborhood of Armor Hills. And so it's been there not quite 100 years.
And so that's it's just east of Warnell at 65th, is that right?
That's exactly right. We're often confused with Country Club Christian Church, which is on Ward Parkway. We're the smaller white church in Brookside, just east of Southwest High School.
And so this name, Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ, when did you first start talking about changing the name?
Well, I've been minister here for a little over 5 years, and when I arrived, I knew that the discussion about the name had been ongoing for years, about members being aware that not everyone knew the history of the name Country Club and it being a neighborhood, and also that when you delve into that history, there are some issues, definitely, in terms of Kansas City's history of racial segregation. And so that had been going on for a long time.
So what issues do you mean?
Well, in terms of the issues of race, as I assume we'll get into, the Country Club District was designed by J.C. Nichols, and it was a beautiful planned community in the 20s. And it was beautiful and wonderful and still is. But it was designed only for white people who were not Jewish. And the neighborhood that our church sits in, Armor Hills, was one of the first in the nation to have restrictive deeds that prohibited people who were not white, prohibited people who were Jewish from owning the property or having the property willed to them or sold to them.
You know, we asked on Twitter what people thought about these name churches that have the words Country Club in the name, and I think there are folks who know that history that you're sharing, but I think others just think the name, the words themselves, Country Club. Katie wrote on Twitter, "I've always found it bizarre. Those words imply a paid exclusive group." Was that part of the conversation at your church?
Absolutely. A big, big, big part of the conversation. Our congregation is a very inclusive and welcoming church that's socially progressive, committed to social justice. To give you a quick idea, our last six members that joined were one was a married straight couple, one was a widowed straight woman, two were single gay men, one was a transgender individual, and we're committed to inclusivity and diversity. However, we're aware that the name connotes to most people a group that's only for people who can buy in, who are wealthy. Historically, often, country clubs have been the place for only white people to be. And the idea of it being snobby and elitist, is definitely something that we deal with and was a huge part of our church's wrestling with its name.
Well, let me come back to the conversation that the church had, but let me bring in for some additional historical perspective, Ladine Morton. She's author of books about many of Kansas City's neighborhoods, the Brookside story, the Waldo story, and also the Country Club District of Kansas City. Ladine, welcome to you.
Thank you, Brian.
So I think a lot of us do know that the full name of our beloved shopping district is the Country Club Plaza, but I gather that a lot of people did not realize what Chase said a moment ago, that there was a Country Club District.
There was, and technically there's no reason why there still isn't. I mean, you know, those neighborhoods are still intact, and much of their legal documents upon which they were organized still probably have that name.
It's actually a collection of neighborhoods.
It is a collection of neighborhoods, and even there you could quibble about where the lines are drawn. In my writing, I've stopped with the death of J.C. Nichols in 1950, so it's roughly the area, say, from Mission Road to Oak, from the Brush Creek to 75th Street that I have spent my time researching.
So it actually spans both the Missouri and Kansas sides.
Absolutely, and I know a lot of people who live out in Corinth and beyond, and even down to Redbridge, would claim some history with that development.
And what is the history of that name? Why did J.C. Nichols call it the Country Club District?
Well, the shortest way I can tell this story is when he started in his first development that would be part of that group up by the Plaza Library today. He was very eager to glom on to the identity of the Kansas City Country Club, which sat where Luce Park sits today. It had the cachet that, you know, Chase mentioned. In that time, it connoted a slightly different thing. I don't want to characterize it as being radically different, but it was a different time. And so the actual idea of it being in the country was very relevant. There was a desire all over the country for people who had money to have a place they could go out beyond the city where it was dirty.
It was, and it was suburban in character.
It was suburban.
What we would call suburban.
Although it really in its origins was more rural because there really weren't that many people living out there. And suburban sort of implies a certain population.
Sure. But now we think of that as the very heart of Kansas
Precisely.
City.
Precisely.
By calling it Country Club, you've alluded to sort of this being a different time. There was a marketing decision made, essentially, to call it Country Club.
Yes, exactly. It was J.C. Nichols. And keep in mind, actually, this was about 1905 when he did his first development. So it was really a 20-year-old development about the time it was reaching Brookside and the Country Club Congregational Church. I'm already ready to change the name for you, Jess. He had been building on a model that included a whole basket of deed restrictions, most of which had to do with the physical development, but did indeed include the racial element. One misconception is that it was specifically laid out in the restrictions, the restriction against Jewish people. It was not, but it certainly was part of the culture of the corporation to not sell to Jewish people.
The language of Country Club, you mentioned the Kansas City Country Club, where Luce Park now stands. There were other country clubs that sprang up in this area, too. Right?
There were. The Kansas City Country Club, of course, had moved from where it started in Hyde Park. It was property owned by Hugh Ward. He was the one who developed Sunset Hill with J.C. Nichols.
That's the area just south of the plaza.
Just south of the plaza, exactly, right around Luce Park. There was such a demand, of course, once the housing development started, for membership that Nichols was instrumental in forming Mission Hills, which came online in 1915. Ultimately, the Kansas City Country Club moved to where it stands today in the 20s when the property was turned over for Luce Park, and then finally Indian Hills shortly thereafter. There was also always what they called a community links that tended to roam around where Nichols had property he wasn't ready yet to develop. But it was a great way to introduce to people the idea of playing golf. Country clubs did not originally revolve around the notion of golf.
They had polo, they had other things.
All sorts of things, almost everything but golf.
I guess maybe this is about more than just Kansas City, Ladine, but when did country clubs stop being this cool thing that everyone would want to be around and be part of, to the place where now a church has to say, wait, that's not a good word for us?
It was interesting. You know, I didn't do a lot of research, but I did try and get some context on country clubs when I was writing the book, because I did a section that sort of focuses on the role of the country clubs. In general, they sprang from both this rural experience we talked about earlier, but also the city clubs. There was a lot of exclusivity even back then with the men's clubs, if you will. But country clubs were initially thought of as a place you could bring your family. So in those first few years, it was fine. But until the Depression, when it seemed like an extravagance, it really fell off through the 30s, the 40s, and even into the 50s. Post-war, it started sweeping up again. And then it started falling off again in the 70s. So it certainly had its ups and downs.
Yeah. And of course, obviously, there are still country clubs that are apparently doing well in the Kansas City area. They still exist. Chase, you know, this isn't just your church. As you mentioned, there's Country Club Christian Church on Ward Parkway. There's a Country Club Methodist. There may be others. How did you come to the conclusion that you know, people in country clubs may not be bad people, but this isn't a name that we want to associate with our church?
Well, sure. I would say, as someone who grew up in the suburbs of Kansas City and moved away as an adult and now I'm back, I knew about, you know, Country Club Plaza, and I knew of this church and its really rich history of social justice work and inclusivity. I thought, well, I don't, you know, love the name, but it's near the plaza. Okay. And as I became minister and began to introduce myself as the pastor of this church with the long name, that I began to have a lot of responses from people, and most of them were negative, from African Americans that have, you know, are from Kansas City. The idea of the Country Club District or even Brookside is for them a part of town that they grew up not being welcome in. And so I would get a visible reaction from them. And then also from just younger people and people moving to Kansas City, not knowing the history, they would think, oh, well, you know, your church must be the church for only for rich people and only for white people. And I'd have to explain. And as I began bringing it up to leaders in our congregation and in sermons and that kind of thing, the discussion started again. And we aren't a very large church, so there was resistance because we all like to get along. And a lot of our folks come from churches where they have felt excluded, and they like what we offer in terms of a safe place. But we began to really wrestle with it and say, does this really communicate who we are? And began to say, no, it is not the best way to put ourselves out there in the community.
All right. Well, let's take a break, but we want to hear from our listeners too. If you were thinking about joining a faith community, would the name matter to you? What does Country Club or that association with J.C. Nichols say to you? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. We will talk about what the Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ has decided when we come back. I'm Brian Ellison. Don't go away. There's a large stone church on Ward Parkway. You've probably driven by it. The first sentence on their webpage under the heading Who We Are says this: for a church that preaches all means all, it might seem kind of funny to have a name that evokes exclusivity. But when Country Club Christian Church was established in 1920, its founders named the church for its geography, as it was and still is today located in the Country Club District. That's from the webpage of Country Club Christian Church. The problem that that sentence gets at is what we're talking about today, including another church's solution. Ladine Morton, a local historian, is here, and so is Chase Peoples. He's pastor of Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ, which is just east of Warnell on 65th Street. We're also talking with you. Give us a call at 816-235-2888 with whether the name Country Club is a problem for you. Does it matter whether you're talking about a church or a shopping area? Share your thoughts. Call us at 816-235-2888. You can also tweet at us. We're at KCURCST. From Baldwin, Matt is calling. Matt, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, good morning. This is a really very interesting and timely and appropriate and right on a discussion, and it's really good, I think, to address this.
Thanks, Matt.
And it's probably needed addressing for a long time. I'm a transplant from Massachusetts, and I was raised in a kind of a more of an Irish Catholic setting there. And when my mom came to visit here, 20 or 25 years ago, and we were driving down Ward Parkway. Must understand, we're from a place where you see churches named after saints with for specific purposes of a particular virtue. She saw the name Country Club Christian Church and laughed out loud. Mm-hmm. I mean, she just thought it was just a preposterous name for a church.
Because anyway, the virtue that it seemed to lift up was so problematic.
Well, it's you have a name that implies you're worshiping a savior who hung out with poor people, named after a place where you go to specifically not hang out with poor people.
Well, Matt, I appreciate that you're sensing the same thing the church did, and that's why they're having the conversation. So thank you so much for your call.
Very good. Thank you.
So let me ask you, Chase Peoples, the pastor of the church. You mentioned that this had been talked about for decades, but finally it happened a week ago. How did the congregation come to the point of actually making a decision?
Well, we actually had to bring in a consultant to help us sort of talk through all the implications of it.
And why was that? Why was it so hard? You said you're a socially progressive church.
Yes.
Everybody knows that this is this is important to you.
Well, it was emotional in a lot of ways, as anything having to do with identity does. And for the members who wanted to keep the name, I, or dearly love them and can assure you they aren't racist and they aren't elitist. For them, they said, well, it's a part of history. And our church has done a lot of really good things over its history that are under that name and that we're proud of, and we don't want to lose that history. And so there was wrestling with Well, what about the brand we, so to speak, have for social progressive policies and work and inclusivity? Do we lose some of that if we change the name?
And isn't that a risk? I mean, that's a legitimate argument, isn't it?
I think so, and it certainly is. And I think it is a risk. We don't want to erase the past because I don't think you can erase history. But the national discussion happening right now over things like Confederate monuments and the names of people on building and so forth has raised, I think, a really good question that was not lost on our people, which is, all right, you can't erase history, but do you want something that may point to a part of history you're not proud of to be on a podium, or do you want it in a museum where there's context to talk about it? And the fact that the past is not past. Things are shape our memory in the present and go on to affect how we look at the future. And so as we were talking about our name, we had to say, look, this is history, and our particular history is a good one. But it also comes with all this baggage that really has, you know, is not who we are. Mm-hmm. And so if we want to try to articulate in as much as you can with a name, is this what you want to lead with? And so I'll go ahead and spoil the surprise here.
You've decided.
That our church a week ago voted overwhelmingly to change its name. And now we're in a process of determining what that new name will be. But it was an overwhelming decision among our membership, not unanimous, but overwhelmingly.
What was the vote?
It was 75 to 18.
Okay.
And like I said, we aren't a large church, and not everybody could be there at a congregational meeting, but that tells you where our church is.
So I am curious, Ladine Morton, as a historian, but besides the plaza, I don't see the name Country Club very much anymore. I see there's several churches, as we've mm-hmm. discussed, but did there used to be a lot more groups using this name, or have one by one they've started to stop using it, maybe for some of the same reasons as the church?
Perhaps. This is the first one I know that's changed its name in this climate, you know, under this scrutiny. You know, churches do change their names. I think of Broadway Methodist that became Keystone. I mean, that's, you know, mm-hmm. so they may have changed their names that I'm not aware, but not for this purpose.
Yeah.
Back to Chase's point about the history, I think one of the reasons there's that remnant of nostalgia, I'll call it, maybe misguided nostalgia, but nostalgia, is because J.C. Nichols played such a role in bringing these churches to this area, saved certain sites for them, etc., built the Brookside building with a meeting hall space so that until congregations were established, people could meet there, etc., etc., that there's, you know, that it's kind of, I don't know, it's maybe a little ironic that, you know, he put that effort into it and this is turned back. But I don't think he would argue with that. I think the Country Club District name was simply a marketing tool for him. It stuck. It worked. It worked for almost 50 years of his life. And there was probably some remnant of that post-war, but it's faded. One of the reasons I wrote the book was not to enshrine the idea of a country club district, but to make people aware that once upon a time, back when planning was more than just how to flip something quickly, there was a lot of thought given to how to bring all these elements, churches, schools, other institutions into this area to make it stable. I think actually the salesman that Nichols was, he'd be the first to say, if a brand's not working for you, find another one.
Well, and I think that's, as Chase mentioned, the comparison to the Confederate monuments debate, that exactly. Often the argument made is these preserve a moment in history, and obviously perceptions change about those moments in history as time passes. But Chase, from the perspective of a church, the relevant issue seems to have been for you, this is who we are today.
That's right. And I want to make clear that from speaking for my congregation, I'm only speaking for my congregation and don't want to come across as judging the other churches that have Country Club in their names or even folks who are members of Country Club, some of whom are my members. But this is in terms of trying to eliminate barriers to people finding us. The caller, Matt, a moment ago expressed what I think is a really common sentiment, which is Country club seems to connote the idea of exclusivity and wealth, and that's not the Jesus that I encounter when I read the Gospels. And so in terms of trying to express who we are and the kind of church we are that welcomes everyone and prizes diversity of belief and thought and of being, of, you know, sexual orientation and gender expression, there's definitely a disconnect there, and that's why our congregation chose to change its name.
We had a question on Twitter from John who says, it's interesting to see how much of this conversation stays the same across denominations. Reverend Peoples, do you know if this conversation is happening at other churches? And I have you spoken with the pastors of some of the other churches with Country Club in their name?
I have not, and sort of purposely through this so that we could keep the discussion only about our church and not to complicate things. I'm aware of, that there are comments and conversations happening at other churches, but I don't know how organized or programmatic they are.
By odd coincidence, as I was telling Chase, I used to work for Midwest Research Institute, and about 30 years ago, we ran a project that helped the National United Church of Christ relocate out of New York. They were looking for mission, a better place to serve their mission. And I've worked, before I started doing these, in community development for over 30 years. This is a common pull. I think it's wonderful that they've embraced this way to do it. I would much rather they change their name than leave the area. This is a wonderful opportunity. They are so great at outreach to bring people into this community and maybe dispel a few of the myths that they may have about it.
Let's talk to Russell in Overland Park. Hi, Russell.
Hi. I affirm their decision to change the name. My first time in Kansas City seeing the word Country Club Christian, I thought, well, that's an unfortunate adjective to call yourself. But I was just recently driving through Overland Park and I saw the South Campus of Colonial Presbyterian Church. I thought, the word colonial kind of has some mixed connotations with it, and as far as our colonial past. And I'm not sure where that derived from, but it seems like, rethinking kind of your identity is not a bad thing for a church to do. Churches used to be very geographical in their naming, and anymore it seems like it's more sort of mission focused. We're Crossroads United Methodist or Grace Point something or other.
Yeah. It's a good point, Russell, and appreciate that. I think colonial might refer even to the architectural style of the church. I may be wrong about that. But, as we move toward the end of our program, Chase, what do you think is a word of guidance or advice you would give to other congregations, having been through this experience yourself, about how you go about a serious conversation about something so basic as the church's name?
Well, nobody's asked for my advice, but
I'm asking
you
now.
But I would just say, I think from a Christian perspective, and I think the kind of Christianity that our church hopes to live out is one that, first of all, we listen to one another and try very hard to express your point of view, but make sure your ears are on to listening to another point of view, but also to be deliberate and try to put the mission of your church first, to think really hard about who are you trying to reach? What is your purpose? What kind of God do you believe in? Do you believe in a God that really does love and welcome everyone? If so, and that's your primary mission, your primary purpose, well, then everything else should be secondary, I think. Even though when it comes to things like names and identity, it can be difficult, and especially history. Our culture's at a time right now where we seem to be asking different questions about our history, and more people are at the table who didn't have a voice before. And so listen especially for the voices that are not heard and try to make sure they're included. And then go forward saying, what can we do together to make sure that everyone who deserves to be a part of this can be a part of this?
That's the Reverend Chase Peoples. He's pastor of Country Club for a little while longer. Country Club Congregational United Church of Christ. Chase, thank you for being with us.
It's my honor. Thank you, Brian.
And also Ladine Morton, author of, among other things, The Country Club District of Kansas City. Ladine, thanks for taking some time with us.
Thank you, Brian.
You can listen back to this show, including our earlier conversation about holiday food and leftovers safety, at kcur.org/centralstandard. Join us tomorrow. Gina will be back with a local doll maker whose dolls reflect the diversity of the kids who might play with them. This show is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Coy Duggar, and Suzanne Hogan, with help from intern Tom Taylor. Gina's back tomorrow. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay tuned now for Up to Date, coming up next.